You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Next is Bread and Roses.
KBOO Community Radio is the proud co-sponsor of the World Beat PDX monthly series featuring Wamba on Thursday, May 12th at the Analog Cafe in Portland. Wamba plays percussive jazz and funk with a strong world beat influence and will be playing two sets that evening. Again, that's Wamba on Thursday, May 12th at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series. This month, May 18th at 6 p.m., will be A Message from Women in Gambia at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University. A Message from the Women of Gambia will feature young women organizers from the All-African Women's Revolutionary Union and the All-African People's Revolutionary Party speaking about organizing for Pan-Africanism in Gambia and throughout Africa. Again, that's a message from the Women of Gambia, a part of the Pan-African Film Festival, Wednesday, May 18th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Student Union Room 333 at PSU, 1826 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwave since 1978. The word on the street is this is the longest running feminist radio program in the country. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. Our engineer tonight is Adrian. Hi. And I'm very pleased to be co-hosting tonight with two somewhat newer collective members, Cheryl and Julie.
Hello.
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 It's great to have you. Let me say a couple of words about the collective and then we'll get started. Bread and Roses is the collective of radio activists who give voice to those working for social justice and equity globally and locally. And we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All of this and we have fun. You can connect with us on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/breadandroses. It's a brand new KBOO website. You can access our podcast there. You can also share any feedback or show ideas. Of course, we are on Facebook, so like us there, KBOO Bread and Roses, and also on Twitter, Bread Roses Radio. And we always welcome new collective members, no experience necessary. So if you are interested in joining us, becoming a producer, host, or engineer, you can contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator. Her email is volunteer@kboo.org. You can also call KBOO at 503-231-8032, extension 213. Well, tonight, so the three of us, that's Cheryl, Julie, and I, we'd like to engage in a conversation about collaboration, collectives, and cooperatives as we explore ways that we can do something different to try to reach our goal of a fair and equitable world for all beings. We have all experiences, opinions, and ideas that we'll be sharing tonight as we discuss lots of different things, feminism, intersectionality, storytelling, feminist theater collective, conflict resolution, education, alternative economies, a lot on our plate. Welcome, ladies. It's really exciting to have you join the collective and have this conversation with me tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great. So, Julie, should we start with you? Let's do it.
All right. Some people might know me as Dolphin, so I just got to say that. But and it's a little hard. My voice is kind of loud in my ears right now.
You want it down? Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thanks. I want to talk about my version of feminism, because I have a very unique brand of feminism that I think most people would not say, oh, she's a feminist. And I also kind of try to avoid labels. So when I thought of the word feminism, the word forbidden was the first word that popped in my mind. And so I think of feminism as both men and women, including transgender and everyone else, including dogs, because I have a service dog, so yeah, dogs and cats, and joining together and doing what people think of as impossible, and making it possible, which I have a historical look at feminism and how women have been treated historically. And that includes for me, because I've had severe disability since I was 11 years old, so they kind of interact. And it was actually my experience, some of my earliest experience with official feminist, who, you know, I met through the women's peace encampment at Seneca Falls, who told me all about disability rights and talking about, well, you know, if feminists are going to be inclusive into, you know, say music festivals or whatever, they have to build ramps. And this is all the way back in the 80s. And so I kind of have the same thing that, to me, feminist means freedom and liberation, and not necessarily saying what you're not supposed to say, but doing what you're not supposed to do. And I think feminists are known for, if, you know, there's a whole law and legal, and, you know, sometimes there were laws against people with disabilities, and sometimes being woman is considered illegal. And I think women choose what they're not supposed to do very, very consciously, and which, of course, gets into all sorts of things. So can I leave it there for
yes.
now?
Okay. Yeah, for now.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
So I hadn't heard, what did you say, Seneca Falls?
Yeah.
I've heard of it, but I didn't connect it to disability rights. And so they were talking to you about that in the 80s, right? Feminism, as feminists, we should be building ramps and making access so that all people can be included. How do you think we're doing now in 2016?
As feminist or as a
anybody?
I'm volunteering at KBOO, so that is, and I haven't performed on stage for almost 10 years, and so I have been trying very hard. So I would say some success, but not perfect, because I've been trying to volunteer and work and do my art and everything for a long time, and here I am on air. So, you know, you have to say it's pretty good, because I have my service dog, I'm sitting in my walker, and I'm talking to you guys about disability rights, you know. So, and The laws have been passed, and I think the National Americans with Disabilities Act, I think actually most people know about it, and the United Nations has the conventions on people with disabilities.
But we didn't pass. We haven't ratified it here in the U.S. Nobody knows about it. We refuse to ratify it. Paul Ryan leads that charge. making sure that we don't ratify that convention. I think 159 countries in the, what's the word? Globe? World?
World, yeah.
World. I was like, 159 countries in the U.S. I think it's 159 countries across the world have ratified it, and the U.S. won't ratify that treaty.
You know, that is news to me. That's really surprising because President Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it was originally connected to a lot of conservatism and actually a lot of military, you know, realized they needed to have jobs and stuff. So I would think it would be a conservative issue as well as, you know, the Democrat, you know, issue. So that's kind of surprising. Really is.
I'm very curious, as you mentioned, performing that you haven't performed in a minute. I'm very curious about what kind of art, if you could talk a little bit about, I know you also do poetry, so if you could talk about the role of storytelling maybe in your life and how, as an artist, you have expressed it.
Okay. I'm a little hesitant about talking about the past because it feels kind of like yesterday, but at the same time, it feels like, you know, a long time ago.
Well, you could talk about what you do now also if you wanted.
Oh, okay. Well, one of the, I think, most exciting activities involving feminism I've ever been a part of. It was living in San Francisco in the 1990s. And I also did quite a bit of performance in Berkeley, which is the home of the independent living movement. And there was a theater that I didn't start. I helped spackle the walls, but I got to perform, and I produced there a couple times. And it was called the Lunacy Women's Performance Project. Have you heard of that?
No.
Okay. She's writing it down.
Okay. Yeah.
It's Luna, like L-U-N-A-S-E-A, like moon sea.
Oh, wow. Yeah. But the connection with like lunacy and women are always considered hysterical and crazy. That's so, that wordplay, that's great. Okay. Please carry on.
And even when I laugh, it sounds really loud. Well, three women started it, and it would actually be, even though it's not in existence, it'd be worth doing a news story on or something, because it really was incredible. And it was in the San Francisco barrio, which is the Mission, which is very, you know, right next door to the Castro. And pretty much anyone could perform there or produce there. And I learned to produce shows on my own. I even got a grant from the Independent Living Center in Berkeley. And they made it affordable. So my show, let's say I did a show called Body Talk Equals Survival, intersections of race, sexuality, and disability. And it had performers from Berkeley and San Francisco. And I could do it, you know. It was a couple hundred dollars with a good sound system and everything. And the audience, the theater held about 100 people. And one of the things I've never seen in feminism that I absolutely love is that they would have a burlesque night. And it was pretty much all women, but, you know, every now and then I think there was a couple guys in there somehow. And it was a combination of burlesque and spoken word and music. And it was just so much fun to be there. And I think at the time it was called the San Francisco Renaissance. I mean, you know, the social movements are always naming themselves. And I was part of another collective called Build, which was pretty good too. Yeah. And right now, because Well, what it led to was the BBC actually called me, and to do a in 1999, and then it moved on, and a film was actually made in 2001, and it was called Julia's Body, but because I used to use my name as Julia Dolphin, Julia Trahan, and now I'm living with my mom, so I'm more conservative, and, you know, Julie, and they got a whole crew together, and we went back to San Francisco, and we didn't get to shoot a performance at Lunacy, but it was pretty exciting. It was pretty exciting to make, and they wouldn't have called me if I hadn't done the performances at Lunacy, which, you know, is just amazing. Oh, Carol Queen, who you might have heard of. That's my one name dropper.
Pretty much. Is the BBC documentary available?
Through the BBC.
Okay.
Right, they have copyright. Okay. Yeah.
I haven't seen it, but I actually read about you years ago when I first got really into working in disability arts. And then somehow at some point in one of the Bread and Roses meetings, you had sent an email and signed it. And I was like, Julie Trahan, wait a minute. And I looked up, that's her. Oh my gosh. So I've been very quiet about how starstruck I've been at all the meetings. So I haven't seen the film, but I read about it several years ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, we'll have to. What?
You're a star.
Yes, that's awesome.
Oh, boy.
Sorry.
And am I blushing?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
Radio world, she is blushing.
Okay. Yeah.
This is really awesome.
Carol Queen, he's a sex educator, I guess. She's Dr. Carol Queen. Did a show called Exhibitionism for the Shy, and that was where I actually learned how to do a strip tease, which is very, very difficult for me. And I had the stripper pants with the Velcro on the sides, you know, and I just pull them off. And and it was just fun. And it really amazed me, because that time while the San Francisco performances were going on, there was, with the independent living movement, there was also just an arts renaissance going on at Berkeley with Neil Marcus, if you're in
the
Axis Dance Troupe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then for the film, the BBC documentary, what I did, because I had just had this huge pelvic reassessment, and they were like, okay, we have the funding, we have everything in place, and are you ready to make a film? And I'm like, I'm at home, and so what I did was I called up some people who, some friends from the Axis dance class and stuff, and which is integrated dance, and asked them if they would help me put a dance troupe together, and to be like an extension of my body. And, you know, we were doing a lot of stuff trying to think about, well, what is it about disability? You know, it's interdependence on other people, so it makes sense that, and most of us knew each other, and by the time we made the film, well, we did two dances together, and it was just marvelous to be part of a dance troupe that felt like, and my role was just to stand there, because that's all I could do at the time, and I mostly stood on one with my weight on one leg, because it was a big pelvic operation that I had, and I stood in front of a hospital bed, and did a strip tease.
Yes.
Julie, would you talk a little bit about like the collaboration aspect of all of this? You know, I think tonight we're wanting to share like the power that also comes with working with folks. You know, would you talk a little bit about, you know, really the potential that there is in collaborating?
I think what it was the woman I named is, I guess if she had a job title, she'd be artistic director of Julia's Body, right? Or, well, we performed twice, and we can call it a dance troupe. And so we knew each other really well, and I think that really helps with why we suddenly were able to, you know, okay, let's make a movie, let's make a film, you know, and share all the roles, because we had a center point, and both, her name is Stephanie Miyashiro, and both Stephanie and I, like, know each other really well, and, you know, I think still now and before then, we're both very comfortable with each other's disabilities. Like, you know, if I said, well, I can't do this, and, you know, it was almost like it didn't need to be explained, you know, and that comes from the dance classes, you know, and just spending time with each other. And then it was just after that, letting people, I guess it was a collaboration, and like there wasn't necessarily any boss, even though of course, you know, you're working with a film crew, so you have your specific, you know, the BBC was there with the director and everything, but me, who's, you know, at that time especially was so much into picking myself up by my bootstraps and, you know, the you know, wearing all the different hats to put on a theater show. And it was just like letting everyone like take turns being a boss, the boss, you know, doing what they were good at.
That's cool. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine, and tonight having a conversation with Cheryl and Julie. We are all a Bread and Roses collective member, and we thought as a very awesome way to Julie's first show, first time on the air. Cheryl's been on the air a few times already. It would be awesome for us to have a conversation, talk about collaboration, talk about collectives, talk about just doing something different, trying to do something different, as I think we're all trying to get towards this feminist goals, values. Well, we're going to take a short musical break. We'll be right back in just a minute. So we're going to Iggy Pop, and the song is
Girls of New York, and it's, oh, I'm so thrilled. It's my very favorite Iggy Pop song, and I found it when I was in Australia. And it's the song that Julia's Body, the dance troupe, that we dance to.
Yeah, we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Store on 9th Street that does a complete transvestite makeover. There's people who sew, people who blow. There's Jewish poets and some who don't know. With an X, pretty girls with a hex, the streets are alive with a rushing river that never dies, and the boys and girls
You're listening. Hello. Hello. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and I'm here with
Cheryl
and
Julie.
Yeah. So before we took a break, so that was Iggy Pop, Girls of New York. Thanks for the song, Julie. So before the break, we were talking about Julie's experience, and we're going to move now to talking a little bit about Cheryl and some of her interest. Cheryl, you want to introduce what you want us to talk about?
Sure. I just love open-ended stuff. Not really. So I actually got into understanding and naming feminism when I was in school for theater. The department that I was in was super, super critical feminist. The stuff I was thinking of saying is all different now after listening to Julie, but... I hear music. So while I was being introduced to feminism through that theater program, it was actually when I was introduced to disability as identity and disability as culture and disability art, although I didn't really fully latch onto it then. when a lot of the stuff that I studied was around the feminist theater collectives, the early ones from the 60s and the 70s. And I mean, talk about collaboration. And it's a lot of like what you were saying, Julie, nobody's in charge. And you know, these theater collectives kind of started in response to capitalism and patriarchy, which are very linear, very hierarchical. This is my job. That's your job. We're going to do all this work behind the scenes, then unveil our product. And the feminist theater collectives were like, no, the process is important too. And we can do this collectively. Not that they were always able to do it, but it was a value of theirs to be interdependent. And to be collaborative and to work in collectives. And, you know, they really talked about the reason that they wanted to have these performance and storytelling and theater collectives was because they were feeling very much like society and media dominated by men is what was defining women. Here's what you are. Here's what you should do. And these women-run collectives were the opportunity for them to say, no, we self-define in whatever way we want. And the early ones, it's kind of interesting, the early ones were kind of the cultural feminism of women are superior to men. Mm. We have a menstrual cycle, which is aligned to the lunar cycle. Therefore, we are more aligned to nature and we are superior to men, which is not really where I'm coming from, but I'm... but that's kind of the overarching philosophy that a lot of the early ones were coming from. And they made great work and they had, they made a great space for it to continue and for people who came in with the next wave of feminism to also have theater collectives. I'm looking down at my notes real quick.
No, I think
I got it. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Do you have a question, Julie?
Not immediately, but well, actually, yeah, because I was part of Rye Crips. Have you heard of Rye Crips?
Yes.
Yeah.
Cryptastic.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about how that mixes like the finding an identity, you know, through theater and then how that goes with what you were saying about putting it out, yourself out as a group into the culture.
Yeah, well, I don't know enough about them to talk about them, but how I got into disability arts, and this was when I was in school for theater, and I identified as non-disabled back then. So I was coming in as a kind of a gawking outsider in a way. But I worked with this, I worked as an intern with this group called Actual Lives, which was founded by Terry Galloway, a deaf queer performance artist who's absolutely hilarious and amazing and very prolific. And it's autobiographical page-to-stage storytelling. So it's it's run in a workshop setting with a facilitator. Everybody writes their stories, workshops them together, and then they're produced on stage. And it can be as simple as a staged reading or something more highly produced. And I went in having no idea what I was getting into. I was starting to understand feminist theater, but I was like, oh, disability, I had a friend with CP in school, I don't know. But I only did the internship because I really liked one of the administrators who worked there. I was like, I want to follow Celia wherever she goes, so I'll do this thing. And from day one, it was just a whole new world, because it was disability as culture and identity. And people told whatever story they want. Some were very impairment-based. There were a lot of, there's always a lot of, you know, here's how I got my traumatic brain injury, gruesome details. But then there were also stories about stigma and discrimination and writing your own story, writing your own narrative. And, you know, I had no status in the group. That was something that I picked up very early on and learned a lot from. Just because I was non-disabled did not give me any status. I was the intern. Mm-hmm. I had to run and go do everything for everybody. You know, go do this, go do that. You're the intern. Shut up. Don't, you know. I over time built a space there. But it was kind of neat to be in this place where I don't have clout, because I'm just mm-hmm. the intern. And there was a lot of interdependence. I could see the way people interacted, the way they asked for support, the way they rejected support. No, I don't need help with that. Why would you assume I need help with that? Not sure. I don't remember your question, and so I'm not sure if I'm answering it at all. I do not remember what you said. Okay. Welcome to my disability.
Okay, I was actually wanting to know how the changes you saw in starting from kind of just also the feminist theater of saying, well, we're superior mm-hmm. to men, and then did it become more integrated
the feminist theaters?
Yeah.
I see what you're asking. You weren't asking that at all. You know what? For my research project, I really only looked at those early 60s and 70s ones that were more the cultural feminism. But some of the books and articles that I read to write my research paper were more contemporary. And yes, they did start to switch to more the fancy term in the stuff I was reading is materialist feminism. Mm-hmm. So that your life is a material existence. Material like the body and objects and the world. Your life as a woman or as any person is not predestined. Mm-hmm. It's not predefined by whatever parts your body has. It's all an experience actually rooted in the world, which means it is socially constructed. And the media and the people around you will give you messages about how you should be. And so, yeah, the later feminist theater collectives use that attitude to say, no, we self-define. And this whole idea of race, of class, of gender, of disability, all of this is socially constructed to some degree. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my experience is my experience, and it's valid as it is. And critiquing it is also valid. So, yeah, they did move in that direction, but I didn't study those. Because I graduated.
Okay.
I'm done.
What is your degree in?
Well, that degree is called, it's got several different names. The area is called Performance as Public Practice. And then my focus was in the Drama and Theater for Youth program, but I did a lot more work with adults than what I should have for getting a Drama and Theater for Youth degree. Mm-hmm. but it's very much about ethnography and anthropology and civic engagement, using theater and performance for civic engagement, not for entertainment. Although it can be entertainment, obviously.
So can you tell a little bit about that?
About which?
About the intention to perform for civic engagement.
Yeah.
Maybe share like an example that you really like.
Sure. Okay. Let me rifle through the file cabinet of my mind. I don't have the key to the drawers. So the area that I was in more was less performance and more going into a group and using the tools of theater to get some kind of dialogue or action taken within that group. Mm. So the only example I can actually think of on the spot is I did a residency in a fourth grade class.
Oh, that's great.
And we, you know, I went through the state curriculum. What are the different social studies and in language arts goals that they're supposed to meet? And which ones of those could I possibly meet? And so we looked at this one particular picture book, and then people took on the roles of the characters and interviewed each other, like as investigative reporters. And so that was their inquiry. And then they had to write up their investigative report. So they got some writing practice. And then we took a trip to Mars. And so we had several newscasters reporting on that. So they had to write. And of course, everybody suddenly was interested in meteorology. Oh, Mars. Mm-hmm. So they were doing meteorology research. Everybody wanted to be the newscast, the weather person on the newscast. So that's not really the civic dialogue part, but that's the only example I could quickly think of where it wasn't about performance, but using the tools of writing a script, getting into character, role-playing, in order to meet some other goal that's not entertainment. So we were doing curriculum. I did work for Sojourn Theater. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of them.
Mm-mm.
They moved to Chicago. They were huge in Portland for a while, and they're a civic engagement theater group. And I project managed this thing called Witness Our Schools. And we went across the state of Oregon and interviewed hundreds of high school students, teachers, administrators, parents, legislators. I met with some of the bigger libertarian policymakers, and that was hard, but interesting. And so we interviewed them about public education. You know, who are you in this? What's your involvement in public education? What's working? What's not? And so I managed that project, and I did about 80 interviews, and we collected them. And instead of writing a report, the artistic director wrote it into a play.
Mm.
And then the actors embodied these different stories and perspectives. And then we took it across the state and performed it on Sunday afternoons for free in communities all across the state, and then tried to engage the audience in dialogue. What are the problems you see with public education in your community, and what can you do to solve them? And there's something about watching it enacted through song and dance and acting and movement that gets your creative juices and your critical thinking flowing better than if, okay, welcome to the town hall meeting. Who would like to go first?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, I wasn't involved in the artistic side of that. Mm-hmm. I was more an administrator, but that's a better example of what the civic dialogue part is.
Yeah, and I'm very excited that where this conversation is going, because in a little bit when we'll talk about what I bring to the table tonight, definitely popular education model is what we'll talk about. So I'm super excited to hear, you know, how that this opportunity to look at different ways that knowledge can be created, but then also can be shared through with communities and stuff. But I'm also curious, whenever you were talking about the feminist theater collective, you were talking about process, you know? And so I'm just wondering if you can talk, you know, personally share a little bit of your thoughts about, you know, collectives, collaboration, process. Was important? How does that reflect for you?
Yeah, I think what's really important and useful about process-oriented collectives is that you care about the process.
Yeah.
It's not about, I don't care what it takes, I don't care how many people I have to yell at or step over, or I don't like the way you did it, so I will do it for you, because we just need to reach this deadline and this goal and put out this product. And I mean, yeah, a lot of our capitalist society runs that way, and even good products can come out of it. But at the end of the day, I don't Oops, I don't want to have to hit the dump button. I don't mind. Now I lost my train of thought because I was so worried about breaking FCC rules. At the end of the day, and at the end of your life, at the end of my life, I would rather be thinking about the time that I actually am a loner and I'm rarely around other humans. But when I am around humans, I would rather be thinking about what we did together and how we uplifted each other and how my interactions with other people helped me reflect and be a better person. Then I would like, well, I fought with everybody, but damn, we put on some good plays. And like, I don't, that's where my values lie. I would, if I'm spending time with people, I want it to be quality time and some kind of positive action or something affirmative coming out of it rather than just what the product is at the end. And I think collectives offer the opportunity because in a collective, you're openly talking about, we're not just going to make a decision, we're going to talk about how we're going to make a decision, as opposed to, well, I'm the manager here, so be quiet while I report on this thing and tell you how we'll do it. Mm-hmm. And the sharing of responsibility. Well, if you share responsibility, then everybody learns something about having responsibility.
Right.
It's really, really so much more effective, I think, and enriching than something super hierarchical and linear.
Okay. Yeah, this is going to be a perfect lead for what comes after this music break. So would you introduce the song, Cheryl? You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine, Cheryl Green. Julie is also with us. And we're having conversations about a range of topics, but really trying to focus on sharing our thoughts around working together to do something different.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So the song is Mississippi Misfit by Mindy Lynn. She identifies as a Crip artist. Also Cryptastic. Just a wonderful disabled artist.
Yeah. I will be right back. Listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine, and tonight on Bread and Roses, we're having a conversation. I'm here at the table with Julie and with Cheryl, who are also Bread and Roses Collective members. And tonight, we've been sharing some of our thoughts and our interests, things that we've experienced, maybe researched, opinions, ideas that we have around collaborating, working alongside others, and what are some of the ways that are fruitful in others, and also how it ties in with feminism and disability rights. So we've been tying in a lot of really, really great topic. So I guess it's my turn to share a little bit about what really jazzes me up these days. You know, I mean, I think that all of us have solutions for how to create the perfect world for ourselves. Like, if I was giving a blank plate, like, oh, wow, I just have so many ideas. But I'm not on my own on this planet. And I really enjoy actually not being on my own. I really enjoy learning from others. I enjoy knowing what people are about and where they come from and the different experiences and the different way to be that there is, because I think it's endless. And that really jazzes me up. You know, it's super, we're super creative as humans. But at the same time, you know, I also would like to be able to come to certain agreements on certain things, you know, because I just really feel that there's a lot of issues out there that I have very little things to say about. And, you know, it's my desire to try to find ways that we can do it. And so one of the ways that personally I've decided to focus on attention in just building relationship with people. And so for me, process, but also egalitarian way of being with each other, of making decisions, of interacting, is really what I try to focus on. Because really, truly, like, I don't know, maybe I'm defiant, but I'm not. I don't just really don't enjoy hierarchy. It always gets me in trouble somehow. So I've been spending, you know, some time looking at cooperative movements, in particular, especially the Mondragon, a model for me in the Basque country region of Spain, has been an amazing opportunity to open dialogue with folks, because I don't think a whole lot of people are aware, first of all, of what are different alternatives to for-profit or non-profit kind of businesses. There are also cooperatives models where so the Mondragon is one of them. In different models that we have, but the one that they have is one where the people who work within the businesses actually own the businesses. And they actually have a system wherever there's almost 200 different businesses, cooperatives, that are actually part of this network. And some of them are about education. Some of them are actually farms. Some of them are industries. They build, you know, medical equipment. They build other things, you know. Also, they build things for operating their farms and operating their schools and operating all the other things that are part of the community. But what's very fascinating for me about it, because I'm also an educator, that's actually one of the main things that I do in the community, is share knowledge, help facilitate knowledge. I learned that actually the Mondragon cooperative system actually started as an educational model. So they were just trying to share skills, and they were trying to share skill in the popular education model, which is a model that was, you know, created. It's been existing forever, which is just a model that just says, you know, everybody has something to teach, everybody has something to learn. It's a very kind of like flat way, meaning like non-hierarchical way of sharing information. So it's a model that works really well for leadership, for really empowering folks to be able to make their own decisions and bring change. And so in thinking about the fact that this model in Mondragon was created because folks were trying to share with each other ways to do things, knowledge on how to build, you know, and also, you know, to a certain extent, you know, the model of popular education is also very much used here at KBOO, where we do peer mentoring and, you know, peer training. So anybody is, you know, able to walk in, no experience necessary, learn, and then be able to then become host, engineer, whatever, and they're taught by other volunteers who had learned from other volunteers themselves as well. So this is kind of like what I'm really interested in right now. Also, I enjoy spending a lot of time with young people and sharing with them and also practicing with them ways that we can make decisions with each other, you know, focus on process instead of just the end result. And also, you know, all of this, of course, sprinkled with a lot of love and compassion, you know, because for me, feminism is at this point in my life not just a movement to bring, you know, fairness, justice, equity for all beings and including our planet, but it is also a way of life. It's also a practice. It's also practicing the ways, the things that are going to help us actually reach that goal of fairness, justice, equity. Love and compassion, I believe, is the key, but I don't know.
It's not. But what do you know?
Not much.
How long have you been at KBOO?
5 years.
And what brought you to KBOO and the Bread and Roses Collective?
So I had been doing community radio back in Bloomington, Indiana, where I lived. WFHB is where I started. I used to co-host a Native program called Native Spirit on Sunday mornings, still going on. And so when we moved to Portland, KBOO is like one of the first places that I visited. Yeah, and got a tour. And really, joining the collective was, you know, one of the options that the volunteer coordinator offered me. It was actually an interesting process because I was not someone who had a lot of thoughts about feminism before I came to the collective. I actually had a lot of thought about Black feminism before because I have a degree in Black studies. So I knew absolutely nothing about French feminism and the French feminist movement, for example, which, you know, joining this collective kind of drove me to investigate further and learn more about. And so I was aware of what Black feminists were the dialogue out there in around the needs and around also the rejection, you know, of mainstream feminism or just feminism, you know, from exclusion of the struggle of other, especially women of color. So you know, it's like I joined, was very, you know, very, very excited, and it's been a very interesting and exciting experience for me also because I have found that this is a place where process is, put forth first.
And do you live in a co-op or collective or communal kind of setting?
No. I mean, my doors are always open. There's always folks at my house, so I guess I kind of do. But no, not yet. Haha. Have you?
No, I haven't. I always wanted to. Oh, I used to read books about it and read about all these intentional communities. Mm-hmm. And oh my gosh, it just seems so wonderful. And then, but now I just don't, like, impairment wise, I don't think I could handle mm-hmm. that much human contact and yeah. potential noise and potential, you're on my schedule today. No. So I'm much more of a loner, just primarily taking care of disability stuff. But I think about that all the time. Like, man, I would still love to live, you know, mm-hmm. on a commune or a collective of some sort, and we can grow our own food. And I don't think I'll do that anytime soon.
And also, you know, I've known and met a lot of people who've had that experience, and it's not always, you know, an experience that functions, you know, for folks. I think that as human, we're still trying to figure out, like, what is the right way for us to actually collaborate, which I think is why I was very excited about having this show tonight, because I don't know that anybody has really figured out, you know, one of the best ways. I feel that a lot of the time, it's because of time. I think that we just assume that things should happen. I think that it's learned also. The culture in which we live says things should happen really fast, you know? And process takes a long time. It really does.
Yeah, yeah. And I find too that I just had my 50th birthday not too long ago.
Happy birthday.
Oh,
happy
thank
birthday.
You. Thank you. And the world is definitely a faster place today, that you're expected to come up with answers right away. And I find in order for me to not feel like I'm the censored artist, I write usually about 3 poems a day.
Wow.
And I give myself, sometimes I write, you know, very almost haiku-like poems, and but sometimes they're fairly lengthy. And having the time and demanding of myself that, and the people around me, which aren't a whole lot of people actually, that I have the time to sit and, you know, reflect and all that. It's people have gotten angry at me because it's like, oh, come on, you know, and it's frustrating, and it's frustrating to me. But I think it's really hard to demand, you know, quality time, thinking mm-hmm. time, emotion time, and for me, time for my health.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's interesting because those things, thinking and taking care of yourself, you know, nurturing, those are kind of the, oh, those are the woman things. And mm-hmm. getting out there and producing and being fast and competitive, those are the men things. And, I mean, that binary is so useless. But we, so many people, I mean, including me even a lot of time, subscribe to it. And I think that, you know, I'm even thinking of, I don't want to say her name, the woman who wrote Lean In. You know, even that, like, I'm a feminist because I support women going to work, except what you're supporting is ways for women to get uber competitive mm-hmm. with men and prove that, oh, yeah, you want to fight, you want to, you know, show off who's got more muscle or mm-hmm. more producing power. Mm-hmm. Women, and I, yes, that's still part of feminism. I don't reject any kind of feminism and say that's not feminism, but that is still part of the game that says taking time for yourself is womanly and therefore bad and useless, and you should hurry up and get out there and produce something mm-hmm. already, because that's the masculine thing, therefore the better thing. And oh boy,
and it's also anti-capitalist, you know, because you should be producing, you should not be reflecting and actually enjoying. For me personally, the goal of life is just to live life, so I'm really enjoying the present moment.
Because that's the one thing you can do, right? That's
right?
The one thing you know will happen. If you're alive, then you will be living.
Yes.
Beyond that,
then you don't know.
You don't. And a lot of it is artifice and jumping in and like, well, I guess we should do it this way. And
yeah.
Well, also, I mean, we're almost out of time starting a new conversation.
We really are.
Yeah.
You want to wrap us up, Julie?
I don't know if I could, but I just want to say I'm so glad that you started talking about the Mondragon Cooperative, because these issues are so, you know, fundamental. Mm-hmm. And it's how do you earn enough money so you have a comfortable home to, you know, write your poetry in, or do that, you know, and, you know, human rights, I mean, human rights require a lot of money, you know.
Yeah. And so we're just barely starting the conversation, as you said, Julie.
Exactly.
But thank you so much for listening. This has been Bread and Roses with Julie and Cheryl and myself, Delphine. Thank you, Adrian, for engineering. Next week, Pamela Santos will be your host. I hear that there will be a great conversation about Beyonce's Lemonade, so I will be tuned in. KBOO.FM/Bread and Roses. That's where you can find us also on Facebook and on Twitter. Have a great evening, everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to leave with Digging Roots. This is We Are. We are the revolution, the solution. Have a good evening.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
War and destruction. Yes, we are. We are. The time is now 7 p.m. You're tuned in to KBOO Portland. Up next, we have your Friday edition of Hard Knock Radio.